Okay, so last time people were asking about this condition G mu d mu r d mu r, which is just G r r, whether that is really the horizon, the event horizon. And just to illustrate it, so I'll do a little calculation that shows you that it is, okay, for a curve. But just to illustrate it, I'm getting quite some echo. Is that okay? You can hear okay? Just to illustrate it, let's just talk a little bit about the metric on an embedded surface, okay? So the metric, and we call it the induced metric on an embedded surface. Okay, so let me, first of all, just imagine I'm in two dimensions. And imagine I have a Minkowski metric. Okay, so what is the metric on the surface T equals constant? Just T equals constant. Induced metric on surface T equals constant. So how do I determine that?
Don't talk about pullbacks. I just want to get it out of here. Yeah. Because if I draw that line, obviously dt is 0, right? So the line element is just dx squared. So ds squared equals dx squared. So that's a perfectly good metric. Now, let's imagine that I drew a null line. Okay, so this line here, well, any one of these lines here, is t equals x plus constant. Whoops. Okay, so in particular, I could change coordinates to, let's define u to be t plus x, and v to be t minus x. And then we see, actually I'll do it the other way around, x plus t and x minus t. And then we see that ds squared is equal to du dv. Okay, because du is dx plus dt, dv is dx minus dt. So that's du dv. So what is the induced metric on the surface V equals constant? Zero. Yep, so G equals zero. If V equals constant, then the only element left is GUU, but that's zero. There's no GUU. So the metric is zero in a null direction. Okay, so now what I'm going to show you is that the metric, that if we go back to Kerr, and if we pick the surface R equals constant, the surface, or rather we'll pick the surface to be delta equals zero. Okay, so that's some particular value of r plus or r minus. What I want to show is that within that surface, one of the directions is null. Then it's the horizon. Everybody happy with that? If I can show that in that surface, one direction is null, then if I send a photon in that direction, it just stays in the surface. And that's the end of the story. Yep. Because that was the whole idea. Okay. The whole idea is to show that R equals constant is the horizon. The value of R at which delta is zero, okay, that surface, R equals R plus or R minus, those are event horizons. That's the whole idea. So what I want to show is that the induced metric on one of those surfaces has a null direction. Okay, that's all I need to show. Yeah. They're not null. So when you do the Schwarzschild black hole, right? R equals RS is, if I pick theta and phi equal to zero or constant, R equals RS is null. Likewise, if I do this and I pick theta equals phi equals constant, that's null. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. I mean, they're null anyway. In the one case, the geometry is a two-sphere cross a null direction, a perfect two-sphere. In the other one, it's an ellipsoid cross a null direction. It doesn't really matter. So it doesn't matter that you have a non-trivial spatial metric in the other directions. There's one direction which is null, and the other ones are not null. Sorry? Nope. If a metric is zero, it doesn't have an inverse.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. No, there's no such requirement. It's not. It doesn't fall into Riemannian geometry. A null surface doesn't satisfy the conditions of Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian. It has a zero eigenvalue. The condition on Riemannian geometry is that the metric has only positive eigenvalues. The condition on pseudo-Riemannian or space-time in general relativity is the space-time metric has one negative, three positive eigenvalues, and it's invertible. Therefore, it's invertible. Determinant is not zero, therefore it's invertible. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about embedded spaces. And the embedded space within space-time doesn't have to be a Riemannian manifold.
What exactly is a null surface? Is it a surface which can be decomposed into null geodesics?
A null surface is one where if I send a photon, it will remain in the surface.
Okay, so for example, if you have the 1 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski, then right. This can be decomposed into null geodesics.
Yeah.
But the metric on it is not degenerate. The metric on it has eigenvalues minus 1 and plus 1.
The induced metric on that line, V equals constant, is zero. Yeah. It's not invertible. Okay, so the metric on a event horizon is not a Riemannian metric. Right? It has a null direction. And the only way to define the area of event horizon is to compute the area ignoring that null direction. So,
is it true that just 1 plus 1 space-time is also null surface? But because it has a direction.
Is it true?
That 1 plus 1 space-time, 1 time 1 coordinate is also
no, null. That's not null. No, good question. So this equation here means that GUV equals GVU equals 1/2, right? That's what this means, because this is equal to G mu nu, GX mu DX nu. So in the UV coordinates, GUV and G and GVU are 1/2, right? And so what does that mean? It means that the matrix looks like this, 1/2. 1/2, 0, 0.
And this matrix has determinant equals -1/4. The determinant is the product of the eigenvalues. So one of the eigenvalues is positive and one is negative. And therefore it's just like spacetime. So if you find your metric has non-zero determinant, then it's invertible. So all this is telling you is you're working in a funny basis, non-diagonal basis. And so I should go back to dx, which is du plus dv of dx. So the eigenvalues of this matrix are 1 minus 1, 1, and 1 minus 1. And that just corresponds to taking x u plus v or u minus v as the coordinates.
But it has null direction.
No null direction. Oh, it has. This has no null eigenvector. What do you mean by a null direction? Do you mean this?
Yes.
Yeah, that's no problem. The metric is fine. The metric in the 1 plus 1 space is fine. It's non-degenerate, meaning it's invertible. The eigenvalues of 1 is positive, 1 is negative. That's what you mean by good metric. Okay. The metric on the induced surface is 0. That's not a very good metric. If I want to show that these surfaces r equals constant are null, okay, then all I need to show is that the determinant of the induced metric is 0. Oh. That means one of the eigenvalues is 0. Mm-hmm.
But you can say that this two-dimensional space surface, two-dimensional plane dx, is embedded somewhere, and we have some direction for photons to stay in this plane. So it fits for definition of event horizon or not?
Yeah, this line, this event. I'm confused about the question. Event horizon, I defined earlier, means a surface beyond which I cannot communicate with infinity.
Yes.
Here I can communicate with infinity. It's flat space.
Yeah.
No problem. So what's the question?
Today you asked that it enough to be the event horizon is that this space contains some direction at which photon do not live.
Yes.
And this thing is, but it definitely not an event horizon.
Okay. I mean, you're right, but what I want to show is that r equals constant is a null surface. That's what I want to show. Okay. So remember, in the Schwarzschild case, right? You see, it follows when you talk about infinity. What do you mean? Infinity means infinite r. Infinite r is when this metric turns into Minkowski space. If I can show that r equals constant is null, it means a photon will stay at r equals constant. Therefore, it doesn't get to infinity. So it does what? It's not true here. Minkowski space, if I'm in one of these surfaces, I get to infinity. Okay. We haven't really studied infinity very carefully. Okay. To do that, you need to do Penrose diagrams and so on. But I'm not going to get into that. So all I want to show is that the r equals constant surface is not. So I'm going to show that if I send off a photon in this surface, it will remain in that surface, and therefore it never gets to infinity. Okay. Yeah.
Just to be clear, could you please write down the definition that a surface is null?
A surface is null. A surface has a null direction if the corresponding Maybe let me say it this way. Any metric G mu mu can be diagonalized. Agree with that? At a point. We showed that a long time ago, right? So all I want to do to diagonalize a metric is I use an orthogonal transformation, and then G prime mu mu is orthogonal. Is diagonal. So we discussed that a while ago. So if it's diagonal, it means it has some eigenvalue. It means it just takes this form, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. And we say the surface is null. Is null if one of the eigenvalues vanishes for all in the surface. Okay, that just means you've got the surface, but at every point on the surface, there's one direction which is null. So for the Schwarzschild black hole, you see if I pick R equals constant, the induced metric was this thing. I ignore the dr term, because r equals constant. And then I have r squared dr mu squared. Now it's very obvious that r equals rs, this disappears. So t is a null coordinate in the Schwarzschild black hole. And that makes sense, because t was a time-like coordinate, but inside the black hole became space-like. So it had to go null across the horizon. Okay, so T is a null coordinate, and when R is RS, this is the spatial part of the metric. So the metric at every point has two positive eigenvalues because it's just the metric on the sphere. And so when we compute the area of the event horizon, we just ignore the null direction and compute it using this. So the area of the event horizon is 4 pi R squared. Okay, so what I'm going to show you is exactly the same thing happens in Kerr. It's not nearly so obvious, but it's still true. That in Kerr, so all I need to do is to compute the induced metric at R equals R plus, say, in the Kerr in Kerr, and show that it has a null direction. Where have I lost my duster? Where did I put it? Must be under there. There? Yes.
Neil, can you move the board, please?
Sorry?
Can you move the board?
Can I?
Move the board, please.
Can you
do the board? The upper board.
That one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. So let's take Kerr at delta equals 0. Let's say R equals R plus. And we're going to just compute the determinant of the metric on the surface R equals R plus. So I drop that term. Okay. Delta is 0, so I can drop that term. And so I have the following matrix. So the only non-trivial part, you see the theta part of the metric is positive, so I can forget about that. The only interesting part is the t phi. Okay, so if I, so gtt, gt phi, g phi t, g phi phi. So that's a matrix that looks like minus 1 minus rs r over rho squared. Over here I have minus rs ar sine squared theta over rho squared. Here I have minus rs ar sine squared theta over rho squared. And then here I have r squared plus a squared sine squared theta over rho squared. So I've got this matrix. So the claim is that this has a, if I set delta equals 0, this matrix has 0 determinant. Okay, so to check that, all I need to do, so claim, if r squared plus a squared equals rsr, which is the condition for delta to be 0, then the claim is that the determinant is 0. And so let us take out a rho squared. I'll put a rho squared in here. Now, rho squared is r squared plus a squared cos squared theta. So I can write rho squared is r squared plus a squared 1 minus sine squared theta, because that's r squared plus a squared cos squared theta. And then when I subtract, in this term, I get the r squared plus a squared minus rsr. And so this thing, if I set delta equal to 0, it will be 1 over rho squared. I don't really care about that factor. Then over here, I get a squared sine squared theta. And here I get minus rsar sine squared theta. And here I get minus rsar sine squared theta. And down here I get r squared plus a squared is rsr. So I get rsr. That should have been squared. Squared sine squared theta. And that's it. Okay? And just take the determinant and you see it's 0. So the determinant is this times that, which gives me a squared, rs squared, r squared, and then I subtract this cross term, and both are times sine to the fourth. So the determinant equals 0, and so that means there exists a null direction. Okay, so that means it is the event horizon. So, any questions about that? So now let me just end by drawing the space-time drawing the graph, I'm going to draw what's called a causal diagram. I'm not really going to explain what this is or curve, but just indicate, basically this diagram is called the Penrose diagram. It was invented by Penrose to discuss the causal structure of metrics. And I'm not going to teach you about those, but I'm just going to draw it, and it will explain exactly what's going on in the Kerr metric. So you see what, and these two horizons and all of that. Okay, so we started off at infinity. This is Minkowski space. This is the boundary. Let me just say, I'll just draw the diagram and then say what it means. This is R plus, R minus. Plus, and okay, so this turns out to be the causal structure. This line is R equals 0. What the diagram shows is basically the causal structure of the space. So we've been dealing with this space as if it was infinite. So the whole point in Penrose diagrams is to do, there's a trick you can do to bring infinity into a finite distance. I'm not going to really discuss that. But this surface here is R equals infinity. Not going to worry about that. What the diagram shows is what happens with these event horizons. So the event horizons are at 45 degrees. If I fell into this event horizon, then I stop being able to communicate with infinity. It's just like in the Schwarzschild black hole. I can't. Light travels at 45 degrees, so I can't reach that point. So I would fall into this region, and I can't reach infinity anymore. That's the R plus. That's the outer event horizon. We saw there was another event horizon, R minus. Okay, so R minus turns out it looks like this, and you could fall into R minus. And then you can't communicate with the region between R plus and R minus anymore. Okay, so it's a second event horizon. And you're, again, disconnected from that event horizon. Now, it turns out you could just keep going. Okay, the diagram goes up to infinity. And if you fell back into R minus, you could come out at another place with R plus. Okay? And you could just keep going forever. So in the Kerr metric, if you extend the coordinates in the way we've been doing, in other words, change coordinates so that these singularities go away, you can actually just keep going on forever inside the Kerr black hole. You might wonder, what is this R equals zero surface? Well, that was the singularity, okay? So it looks like you can't get to infinity out here because of the singularity. But in fact, that's wrong, because in the Kerr metric, the singularity is a ring. Okay, so I can actually get past it. I can get past the singularity by passing through the ring. And so you can actually pass it, and then you can go out to this other infinity. So you can go out to another copy of R equals infinity, and that's a copy that's essentially inside the ring, or through the ring.
What else is there to say? Yes, there's some other bizarre properties of this, which is that in the vicinity of this ring, there are closed time-like curves, which means that my particle could actually go round and round the ring, and as it does that, time will be periodic. Time will repeat. And so that's very bad. It means there's no real notion of causality in this metric. I mean, you can go and murder your parents if you happen to live over here. So that is the maximal extension, what's called the maximal extension of the Kerr metric. That's just if I follow these rules of changing coordinates to smooth coordinates and just keep going, then in the Kerr metric, you can keep going indefinitely, and you find these very strange regions. Now, it is believed that physically these don't exist in nature. Okay? And the reason is that just as this surface is an infinite redshift surface, if I emit a photon here, it gets infinitely redshifted before it reaches infinity. Well, this surface turns out to be an infinite blueshift surface. So in a sense, the whole history of the universe out here, when things fall off to infinity and emit any radiation, it will all pile up on this surface. And the belief is that this surface actually gets replaced by a singularity. Even though it's not singular in the Kerr metric, when you put matter in and include this infinite blue shifting effect, the belief is that this surface becomes singular, and that becomes like the singularity in the Schwarzschild metric. It becomes a space-like surface which is singular. But that's only a belief, and people are working very hard to figure out exactly how these metrics behave.
The other side of R equals zero.
Yes.
Shouldn't be R minus and R plus and so on.
No, it's different. It is because. It is because R can go negative, and so it just behaves differently than R plus or minus. There is a region with negative R.
So the extent even of R to negative region.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you see, R from that diagram, from these, or actually these ellipsoidal coordinates, R equals zero was that dotted line. What that's telling you is R is a bad coordinate, because that's really a line. And so what you have to do is to go to that line and then change coordinates to something else. So in that case, Z and Y would be good coordinates, and then I just keep going in negative Z. But when you do that, you don't come out to the same region you had. And you come out to a different region. You go directly out to a region which is asymptotically linked to space. Without any horizons. Without any event horizons. Yeah, that's the statement. Okay, so that was that is the end of black holes. And unless there are any other questions, I'm going to move on to cosmology now.
Yes. When we say that there are infinite universes in this space, there are infinite universes and something like that.
Yeah.
My intuition is this because, if I'm wrong, just okay. Because when we are in the black hole, the time outside the black hole passes infinity. I mean, yeah, it passes very long. Then, when you get out of the black hole, then the universe has changed a lot. Is it it or not?
No, I mean, when you're over here, you're completely nothing you ever do will communicate with the universe here. I mean, you can only, the best you can do is send a light ray, but you can't communicate with this at all. So, and likewise, the people here, they can't see you there at all. They have no idea what you're doing. Do whatever you like. They will have, it has no impact. Okay? So it's problem. It's problematic. You can see immediately there's a problem with information. So if you try to make a quantum theory of gravity, which is supposed to be unitary, then information is preserved in a unitary theory, because basically in a unitary theory, time evolution is just a rotation of the basis, that's all. You can't possibly lose any information. But if somebody falls in a black hole, then it looks like that part of the system is just disconnected and has no impact on the future. So it looks like it's not unitary. So one resolution of this is that I shouldn't think about this anymore. Okay, that you should really regard this region as a closed box. And when somebody falls through, they just don't count anything that goes through. Okay. That somehow future infinity should be this surface. That's one attitude. That when I talk about the future evolution of this region, I should just define it to be that surface, and that's all. Don't talk about anything else. But I think this is not really a result. Some people take the point of view that in quantum gravity you do lose information, and some people believe that you don't.
Well, what do I mean is that can we connect those r equals infinity to each other?
These two?
Yeah.
No.
Why not?
Well, that's not what the rules of the game are, that I keep going in the smooth metric. I don't know what else you want to do. I'm just following the rules of geometry, and that's what it gives you.
But couldn't it be that the special case is that all the r equals infinity regions are actually the same region?
Yeah, it's very hard to understand what you mean by that, because you know, so if you're saying if I send somebody, you see they're actually different, as I said. I mean, this one has a naked singularity in it, for one thing, right? Because in this one there's no event horizon, so I can just look and see there's a singularity. So this one is very different than this one. So you may want to identify this one with the next one down here, but you can't identify these two. These are really different. And even if you identify them, what does that really mean? Are you saying the universe is periodic in time? Maybe. It's a big assumption. So at the moment, this is just confusing. It is probably an aspect of the failure of GR. I mean, we know generality fails because it gives singularities, and so the equations of generality just are meaningless at this on the singularities. But this type of behavior may be just a manifestation of GR. It's not really a fundamental theory. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to cosmology, which is maybe the most surprising application of general relativity. And it's an application which Einstein didn't expect. But when he developed this theory, he was really trying to explain the solar system and to make a theory of gravity which was causal, and therefore different than Newton. Newton's theory was not causal. But initially, at least, as far as I know, he wasn't trying to explain the whole universe. But in fact, this turns out to be the most successful application of general relativity of all. And you have a course on cosmology coming, so I'm not going to, I'm only going to touch the surface. So we want to understand solutions of the Einstein equations, which have matter and a time-dependent metric. Okay, so we want the general solutions with matter and time dependence. But to simplify, let's assume homogeneity and isotropy. So homogeneity means the space is the same at every point, and isotropy means it's the same in all directions. Okay, and these are inequivalent because you can have, for example, an anisotropic homogeneous space, right? So if you have a crystal, there's some preferred axes, say x, y, and z. So it's anisotropic, but it's the same at every. It's certainly the same at every atom. So it can be homogeneous but anisotropic. So we want both of these symmetries. This is the biggest symmetry you can have in space. And so we will, this is IE maximal symmetry. And at the time of Einstein and the earliest studies of cosmology, this was called the cosmological principle. But the type of theories we deal with today are in fact designed to explain this feature, to explain why the universe is homogeneous and isotropic and not just assume it. But nevertheless, it's a good starting point when studying cosmology just to make this assumption and see what happens. And so we want to assume maximal symmetry. And then in D dimensions, and notice I'm only assuming the symmetry in space. I'm not assuming it in time. I want the universe to evolve in time, but spatially to be homogeneous and isotropic. In D dimensions, the greatest, so this D will be 3, the dimensions of space, the greatest number of symmetries possible, are possible symmetries. The greatest number of symmetries possible. Is d d plus 1 over 2. Okay, so in three dimensions, so this is proven, the proof is in Weinberg, Stephen Weinberg's book, chapter 13. And essentially you prove it using the notion of killing vector. And the question is how many linearly independent killing vectors are there in D dimensions? And it turns out the maximum number is dd plus 1 over 2. It's not very hard to prove, but I'm not going to try. Let's take the three, so in three dimensions, there are three different geometries which have the maximum number of symmetries. The first is the most obvious, a three-sphere. Okay, so a three-sphere has six symmetries. And the reason is that you can embed a three-sphere in four dimensions, four Euclidean dimensions. And in four Euclidean dimensions, you have O4, your space of orthogonal 4x4 matrices. And that has six rotations. I'll do this in a little bit more detail in a moment. You can also have flat Euclidean space, just ordinary three-dimensional Euclidean space. And here you have three rotations. Those are symmetries. And three translations. Okay, so that's obviously has six independent symmetries. I can rotate. They're the three Euler angles. And I can translate x, y, and z by a constant. And then we also have a three-dimensional hyperbolic space, which has three boosts and three rotations. And I'll discuss that in a moment. So I'm not going to prove the theorem, but I will just explicitly construct these three spaces and show that they have these symmetries. And so according to the cosmological principle, the metric on space, the induced metric on space, would have to be one of these three spaces. So to see S3, well, what is S3? S3 is just the space it's just a three-sphere embedded in four-dimensional Euclidean space. And so I just think about it like this. Okay, there's x, y, z, and v, which I can't draw. But there's the sphere. And then, of course, the metric on the S3, I just take the metric on E4. And I set x equals to sine chi, sine theta, sine phi, y equals sine chi, sine theta, actually cos phi, we usually take sine phi, z equals to sine chi, cos theta, and v equals to cos chi. So this is generalizing the usual spherical polar coordinates, but to four dimensions. And if you work that out, you will find, so that's the metric. Plug that into the ds squared, and you'll find this is d chi squared plus sine squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And that is the metric on S3. Now, often people write it in a different way, that if you think about your three-sphere and this angle is chi, this polar angle, then the distance out here, it's a unit three-sphere, so this distance here, the hypotenuse is 1, and so this distance is just sine chi, and that is defined to be r. Okay, so in a typical cosmology textbook, they won't write the three-sphere metric in this way, they'll write it in terms of this coordinate, r, and you can see that r has a maximum value of 1. And so dr is equal to cos chi d chi. And so dr squared is equal to cos squared chi d chi squared, but cos squared is 1 minus sine squared, and so that is 1 minus r squared d chi squared. And so we have d chi squared equals dr squared over 1 minus r squared. And we also have that sine squared is, of course, r squared. And so we can write this as dr squared over 1 minus r squared times plus r squared d omega squared. So that's the usual form that that you'll see in books. And for a sphere, now I did this for a unit sphere, but if I'd picked this to be a sphere of radius r naught, so let's put an r naught in there, there would have been an r naught in here, and there would have been an r naught in here. That would have been r naught squared. This is r squared of r naught squared. So I would have had an r naught squared here. Okay, for a sphere of radius r naught. And so usually this is defined to be dr squared over 1 minus kr squared. And k is 1 over r naught squared, where r naught is the radius of the sphere. Okay, so that is a sphere. And notice that flat space E3 is obtained by just taking r naught to infinity. So just take the radius of the sphere to infinity, and you get flat space, and the k disappears in the denominator there. What about H3? Three-dimensional hyperbolic space. Well, I do exactly what I did with S3, but I embedded in Minkowski space. So it's defined to be this space in Minkowski in 4D. Minkowski space. Okay, so if I sketch that surface, V is up here, and then I have, say, X and Y, and this hyperbolic surface looks like this, and it's a surface of revolution. And the metric, so this is the H3, this surface. Okay? And the metric is dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared minus dv squared, subject to that constraint. And so to solve the constraint, I just say x equals sinh chi. Sine theta cos phi, z equals sinh chi cos theta, v equals cos chi. Okay, so when I square these things, I'm going to get cos squared from the v squared, and the sum of these squared will give sinh squared. Cos squared minus sinh squared is 1. And so then I satisfy this equation. And if you work it out, then you'll see ds squared on the H3 will be d chi squared plus sinh squared chi d omega squared. And again, we play the same trick here of defining this radius r. And so chi turns out to be, so r is sinh chi. And then we find that ds squared is just dr squared over 1 plus r squared. If I put an r naught in there as well, a hyperboloid of radius r naught will be r squared over r naught squared. H3 of radius r naught. This thing plus r squared d omega squared. Okay, so the only difference between the sphere and the hyperboloid is the sign comes in here. So those are the three possible metrics of great of maximal symmetry. And now we're going to try to write down the metric on spacetime. So let's try to write down the most general spacetime line element consistent with the symmetry. So ds squared will be g mu nu dx mu dx nu, including time. And so obviously this is g naught naught dt squared plus twice g naught I dt dx I plus a plus g I j dx I dx j. So that's the most general line element. And now what we want to do is argue that is impose the symmetry. Okay. So the symmetry is only in the spatial directions, and the symmetry means that you see the symmetry. So I haven't really discussed these symmetries. Let me discuss them briefly. In E4, what is the symmetry of the sphere? Well, it's just any rotation, right? So four-dimensional rotation. So the symmetry here, the symmetry on S4 is just, so xi is x, y, z, v, and the symmetry is xi prime is o, I, j, x, j. So if I just rotate the x's into themselves, and o transpose o equals 1, so o is within O4, so 4 by 4 orthogonal matrix, then that's a symmetry of the sphere, it's a symmetry of the line element, and so this space actually has that symmetry. And you notice the symmetry can be used to take every point to every other point. They're all equivalent. You can rotate a sphere to take any point to any other point. And so using that symmetry, this G naught naught has to be constant on the sphere, because G naught naught is a scalar as far as the spatial symmetries go. So this must be, this is a scalar, and it must be, it's invariant under the symmetries, and so it must be, so G naught naught is only a function of T. That's all it can be. It can't depend on space because the metric, because all points are equivalent. Likewise, if we look at this quantity, what is G naught I? Well, as far as the spatial transformation goes, this looks like a vector. Okay? Now, is there a vector which is invariant under symmetry on a sphere, right? Where would it be pointing? Because the symmetry takes you from any direction to any other direction. And so it's impossible for this to be non-zero. So this is a vector. It has to be invariant under the symmetries, under the spatial symmetries. And so actually it must be zero. It just is no vector that is left invariant by rotations. So G naught I has to be zero. And what is Gij? Well, Gij is a tensor, and it's got to be invariant under these spatial symmetries. And so actually all it can be is the induced metric on the sphere times some function of time. And we'll call that function a squared of t, because it's got to be positive so that this spatial metric is not has positive eigenvalues. So gamma ij, let me just define this. So gamma ij dxi dxj is equal to the line element on S3, E3, or H3, depending on which one we choose. And so the line element here is G naught naught dt squared plus a squared of t gamma ij dxi dxj. So that is the most general metric on space-time, which is consistent with these spatial symmetries. Now we can do something to simplify this, which is that we can just define this to be dt twiddle squared. You see, I know that this has positive eigenvalues. A squared is positive. G naught naught has to be negative. And so I just define dt twiddle to be square root of minus g naught naught dt.
Minus.
Thanks. Okay, so dt twiddle is, this is a positive quantity, and dt twiddle squared would be minus g naught naught dt squared, so this equals that. And then I'll drop the t twiddle. So my line element in these coordinates is just minus dt squared plus a squared of t gamma ij dxi dxj. Okay, so So here it's equal to dr squared over 1 minus r over r naught squared plus r squared d omega squared. Here it's just dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. Here it's dr squared over 1 plus r over r naught squared plus r squared d omega squared. Okay, so that's good. It's not really whoops. That's interesting. Seem to have broken the blackboards. Is there something there?
It's on an angle.
Pardon?
So move it down.
I wouldn't. It's on
an angle. No.
Move.
Go up and down.
The other one, I wouldn't.
The one that doesn't work.
You can break it worse.
What's that?
It's clearly broken.
Last time when it happened, you can just move it.
Oh, right. Okay.
So what should I do?
The one that doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
Just move it up and down.
Okay.
And down.
And now come down?
Yeah.
Very good. Must be bent. It looks a bit bent. Okay. Right. So we've got this metric, which is spatially homogeneous and isotropic, has all these symmetries, and now we're ready to work out the Einstein equations. But we're going to put matter into the Einstein equations. So for matter, again, to make life simple, let's assume a perfect fluid. And so T mu nu is equal to P plus rho U mu U nu plus P G mu nu. So we derived that some time ago. And then the question is, what is U mu? Okay, so now again, we'll use the isotropy. So U mu is U0 UI. But if there was some velocity of this fluid, clearly it picks out a direction. We can't have any kind of that. It'll break the isotropy. So no vector is invariant under rotations. So this must be 0. Okay, by isotropy. And then we have g mu nu u mu u nu equals minus 1. But g00 is minus 1 in these coordinates. So that is minus u0 squared. And so that forces u0 to equal plus 1. And I click the plus sign because I want it to be future pointing. Okay, it could have been plus or minus 1. But minus 1 would mean the four velocity of the fluid was going into the past. Okay, so that's very easy. U mu is just U mu is just 1, 0 in these coordinates. And so now I can just read off what T is. T mu nu equals, so it's 4 by 4 matrix. And if U mu is 1, 0, then T 0, 0 will have P plus rho. And then here I have G 0, 0 with upstairs indices. But G inverse is minus 1 in this index. And over here, it's 1 over a squared gamma ij, the inverse. But all I'm using is the minus 1. So I get rho plus p minus p. So it's just rho in that direction, the 0, 0 component. And then if I take Tij, the diagonal components, this is nothing, and I just get P, P over A squared gamma. Actually, I can just write it this way. P 1 over A squared gamma ij in the spatial components. So that's the stress energy for the fluid. And now, now we can write down the Einstein equations. So let's just go and calculate. So there they are, and we know what T mu nu is. We know what, so let's just calculate G mu nu. So first of all, let's calculate the Christoffel symbols. The only non-zero ones turn out to be these. So G mu nu is minus 1 here, A squared gamma ij in these components, G with raised indices is minus 1 A minus 2 gamma ij. And then if you work out the Christoffel symbols, this is what you get. A dot gamma ij, gamma 0 ij is A dot over A delta ij, and gamma ijk is equal to gamma ijk of gamma. And what I mean by this is that, of course, this 3-sphere or H3 or E3, they have their own Christoffel symbols, right? Those are spaces. And if I write capital gamma of little gamma, this means i.e. the gamma on S3, E3, or H3. So these Christoffel symbols are the four-dimensional ones. This is the three-dimensional Christoffel symbol on space. And then if we go and calculate R00, the Ricci tensor, we get minus 3 A double dot over A. R0i by isotropy has to be 0. And Rij is equal to R of gamma ij, so the three-dimensional Ricci tensor plus A double dot A double dot plus 2 A dot squared times gamma ij. And the Ricci scalar is obtained just by contracting with the metric. So I get minus this term, and then so I get minus R00 using the G00 upstairs. And then I get plus A squared A minus 2 gamma ij Rij. And minus 2. And when you work that out, you'll get 6 a double dot over a plus a dot over a squared plus k over a squared. And where this R, the Ricci tensor on a maximally symmetric space, is just it's a two-index tensor, so it has to be proportional to the metric by the symmetry, and that turns out to be 2k gamma ij. That's the answer. And k, I just remind you, is plus 1 over r naught squared for S3. And it's zero for E3. And it's equal to minus 1 over r naught squared for H3. So when we put these equations together, we can get the Einstein tensor. Try this again. So G00, which is of course R00 minus a half G00R. And so that's R00 plus 1/2 R. And if I just add those two things, R00 plus 1/2 of that, then the A double dot over A term cancels. And what I get is 3 a dot over a squared plus k over a squared equals 8 pi g rho. And this equation is known as the Friedmann equation. Okay, so Friedmann was the first person to figure out what the equation was for A. Now, if you look at the metric, let's see, did I just erase it? Sorry, I just erased it. If you look at the metric, then A of t is a scale factor, right? So the metric is here. And this quantity A is called a scale factor for obvious reasons, because all this is saying is that I have this three sphere of some radius, R0, and A is just going to scale it up and down. Okay? So A will just blow up the balloon. That's why the picture is that the expanding universe is just like a balloon that is being blown up. And this is the equation that governs A. We also have the other Einstein equation, Gij. And if you work that one out, you will get minus a dot squared plus 2a a double dot plus k gamma ij equals 8 pi g p a squared gamma ij. And so this tells us that a dot squared plus 2a a double dot plus k is equal to minus 8 pi g p a squared. Now, in addition to this, we have, so those are the two, interesting components of the Einstein equations. We also have stress energy conservation, d mu t mu nu equals zero. And so this is, of course, ordinary derivative plus gamma. So I've got to introduce a gamma for every index. And so this gives me gamma mu mu alpha t alpha nu plus gamma mu nu alpha t mu alpha equals zero. Okay, and I'll just leave it to you as an exercise. Show this implies rho dot. Dot here is always d by dt. Okay, dot equals d by dt. Rho dot equals minus 3 a dot over a p plus rho. Okay, so let's call that 1, 2, and 3. And then, as another exercise, show that 1 and 3 imply 2. So the equations are redundant. You see, if I take equation 1 and I take the time derivative of it, I'm going to get terms involving a double dot here. And if I take equation, and I'll get rho dot. Now, rho dot I can replace using 3 as p plus rho, substitute it back in the equation, and I should get equation 2. So in other words, for any for studying the solutions of these equations, you really only need to satisfy 1 and 3, and then 2 is automatically satisfied. So let's do some simple examples. Actually, do you want to take a break for 10 minutes? I'm good? All right.